Are you or someone you care about feeling overwhelmed by an autoimmune disease? Our guest today has a story or two to tell you. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Our guest is Susanna Meadows. She is former senior writer for Newsweek, a frequent contributor to the New York Times. For the last 5 years or so, she's been looking into alternative treatments for autoimmune diseases. And she's written a book about a few people suffering from this very debilitating problem. And her son was one of those people. The book itself is called The Other Side of Impossible, Ordinary People Who Face Daunting Medical Challenges and Refused to Give Up. You may have had some experiences with alternative medical treatments or looking into them. Are you a person who didn't give up? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Can email us at ideas@wpr.org and feel free to join us on our Facebook page as well. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Susanna Meadows, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, hi, Larry. Thank you for having me on.
You know, before we talk about the book, tell us about what autoimmune disease is and why it's difficult to treat.
Well, it's difficult to treat because, for one thing, we don't know what causes it.
Yeah.
And there are, at last count, I don't know the exact number, there are over 80 different autoimmune diseases that we're aware of. And most of them are mysteries to us. Yeah. And modern medicine can often effectively treat symptoms, but not everybody is helped. And one thing I do want to just sort of point out is that the stories that I tell in this book are about people who exhausted their conventional medical options. So they didn't turn away from medicine, but they tried what medicine had to offer, including our family. And when that was not a good answer, they went looking for other things. So I think the term alternative might be a misnomer because the sort of thing that our family tried for our son was not used in place of medicine, but it was after we found medicine to be lacking.
Yeah, and you're careful to point out in the book that the examples that you show are examples things that actually work for these particular individuals, but may not have been part of formal studies.
Right. Well, it's a good thing you bring that up because the therapies discussed in the book are, for the most part, experimental. And so one thing I was very careful to do was to look at, okay, what do we know about this? What are the risks? And sort of, is there any science that can explain why certain people got better? So in some cases, there are sort of some small clinical trials that suggest why a certain therapy might have helped. But for the real idea of the book is that for a lot of us, there aren't clear answers. And so what do you do in that case? I mean, this is about people who are experiencing an illness for which there's not a clear path forward. And so, when we went through this as a family and when it's your child, especially, or your own life, there is this feeling that, well, we can't stop, we yeah. have to keep looking. And that is the story that I wanted to tell, is how you deal with that moment of reaching the end of your options, and what is it about certain people that makes them keep going?
Yeah, you and the other people you talk about are very admirable people.
I don't know if I am, but I certainly was blown away by the people I wrote about, which is why I wrote about them. The thing that I found so incredible about them was their ability to maintain hope. And I wanted to understand that. I wanted, because when we went through my son's illness, I did not feel hopeful that we would find an answer. And I don't think that I dealt with it well, frankly. But when I started hearing about other people who had been so determined and so sure that they would be able to help their children or themselves, even when no one else had succeeded before, that was what I wanted to say. And where does that come from?
Well, tell us about, and talk this, the story about your son, Shepherd, is an amazing story. Talk about Shepherd and his health issues.
Sure. When Shepherd was three, he was diagnosed with an autoimmune condition called juvenile idiopathic arthritis, which is an inflammatory arthritis. And we noticed that he occasionally was limping. That was sort of the first sign. And so then there was a day when he was at a soccer class and he broke into tears the second he started running. And that's when we realized, oh, there's something really going on here that we have to check out. So he was, by the time we got in to see the right specialist, he was having trouble getting out of bed. And that was over the course of about a month that the disease had progressed that quickly. So we started him on initially ibuprofen, and when that didn't help him much, he was given an immune suppressant called methotrexate, which is very effective for some kids, but it also came with worrying side effects, increased risk of lymphoma. And in the near term, it made Shepherd sick. So he would lie on the couch for a couple days after taking his medication every week. And I, as a mother, you're watching your child lie there on the couch and you think, I could not accept that that was going to be his life. I couldn't do it. And at the same time, the medication was not having much of an impact on the arthritis. So we were really stuck, and I certainly felt desperate. And it was, I think it was the desperation that led me to have a conversation with another mother. We had heard earlier on about another mom whose son had the same thing, and she had changed her son's diet and introduced certain supplements such as probiotics and fish oil, and her son had recovered. And while there was no proof that it was that protocol that had helped him, when you're desperate and you hear about one person having luck, you think, well, maybe I'll have luck too. And so I ended up talking to her on the phone. She was a friend of my sister's husband's friend, and she was kind enough to talk to me on the phone, tell me what she did.
Yeah.
And yeah, so the important thing here also was that we discussed it with my son's doctor. We said, we want to try this thing, and what are the risks? And he was comfortable enough with it as long as we stayed on the medication. And by the way, we were told our son would never be able to come off medication, most likely, that this was a lifelong disease. And so anyway, long story short, 6 weeks later, Shepherd got out of bed and said, "Mommy, my knees don't hurt anymore," and ran off into the kitchen. So we, and then after a couple of months, we were able to take him off medication, and he's been perfectly healthy ever since. He's now about to turn 10.
It's an amazing story. And you, like, I guess most of us, turn to pharmaceuticals first whenever there is a health problem.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing about pharmaceuticals is that, there was a track record. This drug had been used for many years. And we knew what the risks were, and known risks, I think, there's a certain comfort to knowing what your risks are as opposed to not knowing. The thing about experimenting with diet is, and the great thing about it is that you're not really taking any risks. It's something it's not like we're performing experiments on our children. I mean, it's sort of, there's so much we don't know about food sensitivities. And so the only way to understand whether that's a factor is to remove the food and see what the effect is. And so, anyway, that's what we did. We came to believe that gluten, that he had a sensitivity to gluten. And in researching the book, I was very interested to try and understand, what is it about gluten? Is this a real thing? Is this something that, you know, what do we know about gluten that could impact something like arthritis? And there's actually a sort of growing understanding that it can be a factor. And if you have gluten sensitivity, it can lead to all sorts of problems in the body. Anyway, it was very interesting to sort of learn after the fact, oh, yeah, maybe this was the thing, you know. We came to believe, there's no way to be sure, but we came to believe as a family that was the taking gluten out was what had allowed him to recover.
Yeah, and he had something, wasn't it leaky gut?
Well, leaky gut.
Which is a terrible name, as you
point out. The name is terrible. It sounds kooky. The sort of scientific name for it is hyperpermeability up to your gut lining. And in a nutshell, what it is you have it's the lining of your intestine, and you can develop a condition where that lining is letting through proteins and bacteria that shouldn't be allowed into the body, should not be absorbed into the body. And one of the things that can exacerbate that situation is gluten. And so the theory is, we don't know that leaky gut can cause autoimmune disease, but there is a high rate, there's a clear association between the two. Many people with autoimmune disease have leaky gut. But the idea is that these substances get into the body that aren't supposed to be there, triggering an autoimmune response. So the body then attacks these things that shouldn't be there. So there's a lot of sort of circumstantial evidence. We don't have proof yet that one is causing the other.
How did you find the people whose stories you talk about in your book?
That's a good question. It kind of came about organically. I first wrote about my son's recovery for the New York Times Magazine. And in the course of doing that reporting, I reached out to doctors and scientists to, as I said, to sort of try and learn, well, what do we know about food and its relationship to autoimmune disease? It's trying to kind of piece the whole thing together. And in the course of talking to those people, as you do as a reporter, I mean, you always hear things. And so one example, I was speaking to a researcher at National Institutes of Health, and she said, you know what? You should talk to my sister-in-law. She said, she's been through something very similar where her daughter has intractable epilepsy. The family has tried everything to try and help her. But I think, anyway, so she said, why don't you talk to her? I think you would have a lot to say to each other. And I reached out to, so I did. I called the woman, Annie Solofsky, and I talked to her, and she told me about her daughter's troubles, and that they had tried everything in medicine, they tried everything outside of medicine to try and help their daughter's seizures. Nothing had helped. She also had autistic traits.
Boy, I've got to break in on you, Susanna. This is a fascinating story, and we're going to take a quick look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back and talk again with Susanna Meadows. You stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the author of a book who wrote about new ways to treat autoimmune diseases. And if things aren't working for you with what treatments are that you have, why it's so important to continue to look for solutions. Our guest, Susanna Meadows, former senior writer for Newsweek, frequent contributor to the New York Times. Her new book is called The Other Side of Impossible, Ordinary People Who Faced Daunting Medical Challenges and Refused to Give Up. And I have to tell you, these stories are riveting stories, and I certainly hope you'll have a chance to take a look at the book. Maybe you've had an autoimmune disease. Maybe a relative or friend has. Maybe you can talk with us about what you did or what didn't work for you. And I hope you'll join in with your questions for Susanna. She's got a lot in here about hope and stick-to-itiveness in these stories, and they are fascinating stories. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page. Love to hear from you. And Susanna, sorry I kind of broke in on you there.
Not at all.
Right before the news, you were talking about someone you met almost by chance, in a way.
Right, who became, when I heard this mother, Annie, talk about her struggles and her incredible determination to keep looking for an answer for her daughter, I realized, oh, this is what my book is about. And I asked if she would let me write about her. There's another woman in the book who, I mean, really, I picked people because their stories and their determination blew me away. And yeah. One of the women that I ended up writing about is this woman, Terry Walls, who's a physician in Iowa.
Yes.
She has MS, and she was, her disease had advanced to such a state that she was using a wheelchair, a reclining wheelchair, just to get through the day. She takes it upon herself to, because at that point medicine was no longer helping her, which is the usual thing with MS. Once you get to a certain point, it keeps progressing. What I found so interesting about her was that she thought that she could find an answer for herself, and she did.
Yeah.
That's the incredible thing. She adopted this. She did research. She dug into the biomedical literature. She put together a plan for herself based on an idea about the mitochondria in her cells maybe being a factor in her MS. She starts eating 12 cups a day of fruits and vegetables. She uses electrostimulation on her muscles to cause, to create contractions. Anyway, within the year, she's riding a bike again.
Hey, it's just absolutely amazing. Now she's.
It's an amazing story, and I heard it, and I thought, how has no one written about this woman, and when can I meet her? So I very quickly flew out to Iowa to spend some time with her.
Yeah, I thought to myself, boy, I'd like to meet her. She sounds like such an amazing person. Well, frankly, all the people that you write about are pretty pretty amazing to me. Now, but there's someone who's she's a doctor, you know, a physician.
Right.
And so she has a lot going for her when it comes
right.
to research and that. But there are others that you write about who had no experience in that area.
Right. I mean, one of the other people that really floored me was a mom whose son had severe food allergies. And as many people listening know, there is no solution for that. There's nothing your doctor can do for you if you have a severe food allergy, except tell you don't eat this food. We don't have a cure. But I wrote about a family who moved across the country. They moved from Colorado to Massachusetts in order to be treated by a woman who'd had lots of anecdotal success with people. But again, the thing that it was amazing to me about her was that her doctor is telling her, you know, this is not something that works. We don't have a cure yet for allergies. This mother is just so determined, to help her child, that she goes to investigate this therapy. It's an experimental therapy. Anyway, now her son is eating everything.
Yeah, the woman was Amy Thieringer, who...
Well, so the therapist's name is Amy Terringer.
Oh, Terringer, that's how it's
called. Yeah, I ended up reaching out to... I spent a lot of time with Amy trying to understand what she does. She put me in touch with the parents of 100 children that she's treated, all of whom told me that before they went through the therapy, their children, had severe food allergies, including anaphylaxis, trips to the ER, EpiPens, the whole bit. And then now, having gone through the therapy, they are now eating everything. And because of this incredible success, Boston Children's Hospital has now undertaken a study to look at what Amy is doing, because if they can first, you know, if they can document that this is effective, then obviously more people can be helped.
Yeah. I have to tell you, I was scratching my head and wondering to myself, what she does is kind of way out there.
It's definitely way out there. And I think one of the kind of things that I learned in doing this research is, you know, a lot of our answers that now we are kind of used to, and a lot of therapies that now seem normal to us, when they were first introduced, they seemed out there also.
Yeah, that's right.
Talk therapy was not accepted at the beginning. And there's a therapy that's just experimental, and it's just in clinical trials now, that involves, you know, reintroducing small amounts of, say, peanut to a child who's allergic to peanuts. You know, I spoke to the researcher who has done many of those trials. He said, you know, when we first started, people thought we were nuts. No pun intended. And he said, now, you know, 10 years later, you know, there are lots of studies verifying that this can be somewhat effective. So the issue with that is that they have not been able to prove that that tolerance sticks, and that sort of, you know, so they're kind of stuck. But the fact is, new things often seem out there, I think we make a mistake when we dismiss things without understanding them, just because they seem wacky.
Well, a lot of people want to visit with you, Susanna, so let's take some calls here. Angela in River Falls first. Thanks for waiting, Angela. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just wondering that I just joined the show a little bit ago, but in her research, when she was talking to people, how often the conversation came up, like with gluten allergies specifically, I've been doing some reading, how they don't have the same type of issues in Europe and other countries because they haven't processed the wheat in the same way that we do here, how we so often overprocess so many of our foods. And in the same way with allergens too, how it seems like we're kind of creating this ourselves just because of the way our food guidelines have been and allowed to use chemicals and processing. And I'm just wondering what she found in her researcher stories regarding that.
Yeah,
sure, Angela. I had heard those same things too, and I was never able to find any sort of study that could verify that information. And in fact, one of the sort of world's leading researchers into celiac disease comes from Italy, and he does some of his, you know, and so he's as you know, celiac disease is an autoimmune disease that's an intolerance of eating gluten. It does exist in Europe. So I'm not sure that we can say at this point that it's because of how they're processing. The fact is, gluten, this is one of the more interesting things I learned about gluten, is that it's the one protein that our bodies cannot fully digest. So, yeah, it can't get fully broken down. And this is probably why it causes problems, that the body reacts to it the same way that it reacts to a foreign bacteria. It sort of reads it wrong. And that can begin this kind of cascade of issues when the body sees gluten, or it sees it as bacteria, but as something harmless like gluten. So the answer to your question is, we don't know.
But there is, you do talk about, just to talk about food for a minute, I mean, you do give examples of people who have changed their diets, obviously,
right,
and have really had some success.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, one of the stories I write about is a family dealing with their child's ADHD. And what happened was that the child did not want to go on medication. I mean, medications are effective, but there are risks. We don't know what the long-term effects of stimulants are to a developing brain. And the child said, I don't want to change my brain. I don't want to do that. So the pediatrician actually said, you know, let's try this thing where we take 8 foods out of your diet. We introduce them one by one to see if there's any response, to see what the reaction is. Because as the pediatrician told me, we don't know about we don't know enough about food sensitivities to know how certain foods might be affecting certain people. We just don't know that much about it. So let's give this a shot. And this, it was very effective for this child. He ended up really, and the change in diet had a huge impact on his ADHD symptoms. What was interesting to me, one of the most, and I couldn't really believe it, was if you actually look into the literature, there are quite a few studies showing or suggesting that taking certain foods out of a child's diet who has ADHD can have a very positive impact. But we don't know, but I mean, I'm sure that's news to most people. I mean, that's just, it's something that we're just not that familiar with. And it's not, and I'm not even sure a lot of pediatricians know about that. So that was sort of one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, is to just sort of say, well, here's what we know about this stuff, because I think a lot of us are in the dark.
Let's go to, thank you again, Angela. I want to give Laura and Superior a chance to join in. Laura, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Wonderful guest. I have had rheumatoid arthritis for 34 years. I'm fourth generation. And I think that was some motivation in eventually trying to treat my disease without medication, or at least a reduced amount of medication. I somehow felt that the answer was going to have something to do with food. Mm-hmm. Over a year period, I finally located Dr. Joel Furman, a medical doctor that specializes in nutritional counseling. And I went out to New Jersey and did a therapeutic water fast, which most people have never heard of, but it allows the body to heal itself. And I fasted on distilled water for 18 days under supervision.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And,
and it helped.
I've done it many times since. In fact, out in California, in Santa Rosa, there's a place called True North that also follows the same philosophy.
And it helped you.
And it helped. And I first learned from Dr. Furman how to eat when you have an autoimmune disease. Mm-hmm. So I stay away from all animal products and wheat, oils, sugars, that kind of thing. And
yeah.
How are you feeling, Laura?
I'm feeling very well. A big part of what I've been doing since I took control of this disease, I like to think of, is water therapy.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, one thing that we have not talked about yet is the microbiome. And I'm sure both of you are aware of the emerging science about the microbiome,
yeah,
which is this population of bacteria that lives mostly in our gut. And there is a very high, so among people who have autoimmune disease, there's a relationship between having a sort of less healthy microbiome than people who don't have disease. And at the same time, having a very populous, healthy population is associated with good health. And so one of the main ways that we can affect this population is through food. And it's just a very simple thing, because it's, these bacteria are living and you have to feed them. And you have to feed them foods that you have to feed them fiber, whole mm-hmm. food. So if you're eating a lot of processed food, a lot of sugar, a lot of refined flours, those things don't make it all the way down to the large intestine, which is where your bacteria live. I mean, it's such a simple idea. So anyway, I think that as we go along, obviously we're going to learn a lot more about it. Luckily, it's a very popular, it's sort of the hottest topic in biomedical research. And so we're going to get to answers, but it does lend support to the idea that food is going to be or is likely a factor in these diseases.
Yeah. Laura, thank you. I want to give Troy and Chippewa Falls a chance to join in. Appreciate your calls, your call, and let's see here. Let me get to Troy. Hi, Troy. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to ask your guest a question. My son, last May, had a bout of diarrhea.
Mm-hmm.
Up until this point, he was, you know, playing basketball, healthy. He seemed fine. But anyway, mm-hmm. he had a bout of diarrhea. He had some, like, his eyes kind of swelled up for a couple of days during that week. Mm-hmm. The diarrhea cleared up, and then the very next day, he couldn't get out of bed.
Mm.
His joints were so swollen and so sore, his knees and his ankles and his elbows and his wrists and everything.
Right.
We tried some stuff. We took him to Mayo Clinic in Rochester to a juvenile rheumatologist.
Right.
He had said it was a classic case of reactive arthritis brought on by a bacteria in the diarrhea.
Right.
So we put him on prednisone right away.
Right.
And things never really cleared up. I mean, obviously we took Lyme's tests and blood tests, and we saw inflammation levels that were through the roof and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
So after a while of being on those kinds of things, he put him on methotrexate, which he takes once a week.
Uh-huh.
And then just recently, he said, now it's moved to rheumatoid arthritis and it's not reactive arthritis anymore. So now he started him on Humira.
Uh-huh.
And you know, like you said with your son, the methotrexate kind of makes him kind of, you know, the prednisone and the methotrexate combination are not great on anybody's body.
Right.
So with Humira, you know, I just can't see, I guess I'm just worried that I don't know what else to do.
Yeah.
Well, here's what I would say, Troy. I mean, I obviously am very, I'm sorry that you're going through this. I know how tough it is, especially to be a parent in this situation. I think there are things for you to look into. I think, you know, just getting back to what we were saying a couple of minutes ago about the microbiome, there are people who have rheumatoid arthritis. A majority, I think it is, of people who have rheumatoid arthritis have an unbalance of bacteria in their guts. And this isn't to say that we don't know if one causes the other, but there's a clear association there. And I mean, I can recommend a book. There are a couple of microbiologists at Stanford who've written about gut health. Their last name is Sonnenberg, and they were a great source for me when I was working on the book. And what they talk about in their book, which is called The Good Gut, and I sort of summarize it in my own, but they talk about how this gut bacteria is related to inflammation and why it matters and what you can do to make your gut bacteria healthier. Which involves basically eating more vegetables. So it's not really, you know, you're not really taking any risks there. But if I were you, I would stay on top of the microbiome research. And there are certainly people at NYU who are looking at RA and the microbiome, and just stay up on those studies. Because believe it or not, not every doctor does. I think they don't, you know, sometimes they don't have the time. And so I think that you can do your own. I mean, that was the sort of thing I learned, is that, you know what, you can kind of become your own researcher and learn what the experts are learning. Because this information is available now. You can go to the NIH website and read through biomedical literature. But the thing you're going to want to look for is RA and microbiome. And, you know, I think that I wish you luck. And I think that there's a chapter in my book about a woman with RA who tries various things to get better, and who grew tired of taking the medication, and she, there might be some good information in there for you about what different options are.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. I think there are some possibilities. Certainly, Troy, you could take a look at the other book you mentioned was The Good Gut, but your book I think, as well. The other side of impossible, you know, gives us some good ideas and where to go for more information as well. And the stories are so inspiring. I think they're, in so many ways, they're, you've written a wonderful book here, Susanna.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I wish we had more time, but I appreciate your time and appreciate reading your book. Thank you.
Thanks so much. It was really a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah. Susanna Meadows is the author of The Other Side of Impossible, Ordinary People Who Faced Daunting Medical Challenges and Refused to Give Up. It really is a fascinating book, and I certainly recommend you take a look at it. And here we are, out of time. Tomorrow we got, tomorrow's Friday already. I can't believe it. Garden Talk is coming up again, and we'll be talking about fall gardening with our guest from University of Wisconsin Extension. So I hope you can join us for that. And please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.